Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC's Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And Christy, on our show today, we're going to be talking with Ryan Keith and Loretta Muss of the North Carolina Cancer Hospital Patient and Family Advisory Board about cancer care and families.
Such an important conversation. I know both of us have had loved ones with cancer in our families, and so it's something that affects both of us as human beings and also as physicians caring for families.
Our patients, our loved ones, their families, their children, their parents. We'll hopefully learn a lot, and hopefully we can have a great conversation. First, though, Christy, we have some interesting research that matters that I think can inform sorts of conversations that patients and doctors have. What's our very first one about nursing homes and the types of staff that they are staffed by?
Well, this is an article that looks at cross-cultural comparisons. So they're trying to figure out, are there particular things about staff, people who take jobs caring for elderly and people with dementia, compared with just people in the general population who take other jobs, to see if there's certain things that are identified to be different about these people.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. This research was done in the Netherlands and in Germany in collaboration and published in Issues in Mental Health Nursing. And perhaps, as one might expect, that those who are working in nursing homes are more tolerant of people, perhaps, than some of the general population, that they tend to have a longer fuse in understanding that they're going to be dealing with difficult patients and difficult conditions and have to do lots of things that could be monotonous to some people. So these are the types of people. So at one level, maybe that's not so surprising, but I found that some interesting other items.
Well, I liked, it did make sense to hear that they were slower tempered and more systematic or into routines. But I liked this part that they had more optimistic attitudes in situations that might worry most people, and perhaps more confidence in social situations and in the face of danger or with uncertainty than other people. That makes sense that as you're around a lot of older people or very ill people who may pass away or who may be unpredictable, in particularly with dementia, you might not know how a patient will be on a particular evening, that the people who work there tend to be a little more okay with uncertainty.
And what I really thought is, okay, if I have a loved one or one of my patients is going into a nursing home, and I get asked this question, I'm sure you do as well, by family members, how do I know what's a good nursing home? Well, one factor, and I think people can use this, is to say, interview the staff.
Yes.
And do the staff appear to be more slow-tempered? Do they appear to be more stoic and reflective? Are they more systematic? How do they respond if you talk to them about issues that might involve danger or uncertainty? And if they breed that confidence, they're probably the right sorts of people mm-hmm. you want caring for your loved ones.
Mm-hmm. I'm certainly grateful for the people who are drawn to that type of work.
Absolutely. Well, let's look at our next research that matters that talks about the types of things that we as doctors prescribe medications for our patients and perhaps things that we don't really know how it's heard as well as we might think.
Well, I love the studies because it was taken from the New York Times. There was an article on low rates of medication adherence. And then they took all of the online discussion after that and pulled that, excluding comments from physicians, to see what sort of themes arose and what we could learn about what people are thinking.
Yeah, this was actually a qualitative analysis of the comments that people just spontaneously wrote in about the New York Times article. So we wouldn't necessarily say, well, is that a great research study? But it's qualitative and it's hypothesis generating. And what they found was really interesting about perhaps some themes that patients in general, listeners, have profound distrust of certain aspects of the prescribing rituals.
Well, a considerable mistrust of medicines, of medical practice, and a lot of information about patients not communicating with their doctor about medication adherence. So just taking the prescription and not filling it or not taking it, but revealing that they didn't talk to anyone about that or making their own decisions about when and where to take medicines.
Right. It suggests that this whole process of prescribing a medicine is much more complex than I think many of our colleagues and ourselves have fully appreciated. And when we're prescribing a medicine, we need to stop and say, this is not an easy decision about whether to take this or not. Let's talk a little bit about why I'm recommending it, and then talk a little bit about how you feel about that, and then open that conversation up so that people can say, you know, I'm not sure I really want to take that or not.
Well, it's so important because so many medicines that people are prescribed are maybe just for symptoms and aren't actually going to make a difference for their overall health. And other ones are very important to help reduce their risk of stroke or heart attack, for example, with blood pressure medicines. So being able to have those open conversations about which ones really matter for your health and which ones are sort of up to you, all of that is part of that important relationship and discussion between a physician and the patient.
Yep. And send us, as listeners, your own experiences with prescribing that you've had with providers. What's worked well? What hasn't worked so well? And we'll talk about them on the air. What about our very next Research That Matters, Christy?
Okay. The next one is about these PFCs that are exposed in food wrappers and food contaminants. They're in pizza boxes.
Packaged foods, the sorts of things that oftentimes are in there that many of us routinely see, like popcorn.
Exactly.
Microwave popcorn.
And so there was theory that this could cause immune suppression in rats. And so they wanted to look at real human beings, look at children ages 5 to 7 years, follow their body levels of these PFCs, and then see what effect, if any, it had on their response to immunizations.
Yeah, this article was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and these PFCs are perfluorinated compounds. We'll call them PFCs, but they're really ubiquitous. They're in the environment as well. And what they found in really looking at these hundreds of children were that they were detectable not only in their bodies, but that the children had less antibody responses to these common childhood immunizations if they had this exposure, so that they perhaps did not have the same level of antibodies that they might would have had if they didn't have this exposure.
Yeah, so it can't say that these children are more likely to get sick than others, but it did suggest that their immune response to vaccinations are somehow different and not as high because of or related to this exposure to the PFCs in their body.
Right. If there was a twofold increase in if they had in this concentration, this PFCs was associated with a twofold kind of decrease in the levels of their antibodies. So there is an immune effect.
Mm-hmm.
We should really be more cautious and aware of things that maybe are, you know, putting things in microwaves.
What made me think I shouldn't reheat the pizza in the pizza box.
Absolutely.
Put it on a plate.
And maybe I should just do popcorn on the stove rather than the microwave.
That's a big step for me.
Big step. More to come. Our very last research that matters about as we age in our parents and we think about their prognosis, what do we know that can maybe predict whether or not certain tests would be beneficial or not for them?
So this was a study that was done in JAMA. It was a systematic review, meaning they took a whole bunch of different studies to look together to see if we can identify elements that predict risk of death. Looked at over almost 22,000 different titles and identified 16 different sort of predictors of when people live in the community or live in the home or live in the hospital to try to figure out which things could predict longevity.
And while I think we're learning from this research better ways to help give people data that they need to make decisions about what sort of things they might have. So, for instance, if you're 80 and healthy, should you have a colonoscopy again? Versus if you're 80 and have bad heart failure, should you have a colonoscopy again? Those are the types of really clinical decisions we need some help with. This research says we're getting there, but we're not there yet. Stay tuned.
Completely agree.
Well, Christy, we've had time to talk about not only about prognosis and more research that's needed, but about the personality of the staff in the nursing home, maybe helping our listeners think about and ourselves what we want when we're interviewing them.
A little bit about patients' skepticism of medicines and of doctors' prescribing habits.
And perhaps having a little higher skepticism ourselves of some of the environmental contaminants that we may be exposed to, and maybe some very small common sense things we could do to lower our risk of having that contamination.
So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. Adam, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we are going to have a great chance to talk with Loretta Muss and Ryan Keith of the North Carolina Cancer Hospital Patient and Family Advisory Board about cancer care and families. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with coordinator of the North Carolina Cancer Hospital Patient and Family Advisory Board, Loretta Muss, and Ryan Keith, a member of the board, about cancer care and families. And we are grateful to have you with us, Loretta and Ryan. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Let's dive right into this issue, which I think affects virtually every family across the country at some point in time or another. Many are probably experiencing it now, which is how cancer affects families. Perhaps you can just tell us, Loretta and Ryan, how and why you're involved in this issue.
Well, it actually, this issue was brought to the board by a board member. What are we doing for caregivers within the hospital? And so we decided to sort of bring minds together and see what we could do to start building a program that addressed the special needs of being a caregiver for a patient who has a diagnosis of cancer.
Which is a huge life-changing diagnosis, not just for the patient, but for the family members.
It's huge.
And how about you, Ryan? How did you get involved?
I was a caregiver for my wife who had breast cancer and a 7-year survivor and then got lung cancer. And I was her caregiver, and I was given an opportunity to work with the board and thought, you know, this is some place that I think I can help some folks out because I've been through this. And I think it's just a wonderful opportunity to try to help other folks.
Well, let's talk about, when we talk about caring for families and caregivers, what exactly, I mean, I think we have a general sense, but tell us more about what that means to care for the caregivers.
Well, one of the things that we're doing over at the North Carolina Cancer Hospital and the Resource Center is we have regularly scheduled gatherings of caregivers. And the day before, Loretta goes up on the hall and takes bulletins that announce the upcoming event, invites people to come down, and they join us for about an hour for coffee and pastries. And they're able to share information with each other. There is a facilitator there who is a member of the team, a member of the staff, and they set a comfortable environment so that folks can share, and they do. It is truly amazing how people begin to open up.
What type of information, Loretta, would family members share that others would find really useful in such a setting?
It's actually, it runs the spectrum. There will be somebody who will say, I need to know how to deal with the anger of my time being taken away, of the demands of the patient, of not understanding the course and the prognosis, to just having a milieu with nobody looking at you and pointing a finger and saying, you shouldn't feel that way. So what we're doing is bringing these folks together in a comfortable setting where they can share, in addition to the fact that we have staff that attend this, so they know the staff at the same time, and the staff can guide them in the conversation to understanding that they know what they're going through. You know, we've actually had someone come in and share how she has now taken over her husband's role of such as simple things as taking out the trash to managing the finances. So having people share this is very comforting to be able to know that you're not alone. And it's working. In addition to, we're finding that by board members and folks who are volunteers who participate in this, going up to the floors and bringing them down is yet another connection of warmth that we're trying to find.
What about, I think this sounds amazing. And for those that are experiencing cancer care and are in the cancer hospital, and I know we'll want to come back and hear more about those services, but there are so many patients and families for whom the experience is isolating, and mm-hmm. they are in their homes
right.
alone. How is that experience? How do you approach that experience right at the beginning?
We're working on that because this is a brand new program, and we know that while we start within the hospital, that this is only a tip of the iceberg and that we need to start branching out, where we would need to hire a case management worker who will touch base with those caregivers after they take the patient home. How are you doing? Let me get some resources for you. What about your church? Teach you how to ask for help and what kinds of help are going to help you.
I wonder, you know, I think about the impact of this kind of care on the caregivers themselves, on their abilities to sustain the energy, the emotional energy, the physical energy to continue to care for their loved one and to be able to carry on if in fact that loved one passes away. But I wonder, too, the impact it has on the patient with cancer of having caregivers and a family support system that has this extra kind of nurturing behind them. Do you know what I'm asking of sort of how this then in turn impacts the patient with cancer to have loved ones who have an outlet?
I think the patient with cancer has a much more positive attitude about his or her condition, and I believe a positive attitude yields positive results. An example would be my own wife. We were very fortunate to have a good group of friends who would pitch in. There was one point when she had lung cancer, I was ready to take a leave of absence from work. And her mantra was, no, Ryan, we need the money. We need the insurance. You're going to stay at work. Mm-hmm. We have friends that can help. And it was friends from our church. It was friends from the neighborhood that volunteered. When I couldn't take Jane to the hospital over here at Chapel Hill, they would take her. And so I think that really contributed to a better outcome for her mm-hmm. over the duration of her illness. She maintained a very positive attitude.
And, well, I know the outcome for the patient with social support, we've known for a long time that if you provide social support in chronic disease, it's critical. What I think is really interesting and fascinating here is this realization that providing support for the caregiver here, because as I'm just hearing briefly about your experiences with your wife and the two forms of cancer, I can only imagine that you had to not only be there in social support, but you also had to acquire expertise as a patient advocate in those disease states. You had to have knowledge about advanced planning and directives. You had to be thinking about, well, what happens after she's gone, and a funeral and obituary. You had to think about, how do I get her logistically to different places and help out? What about the interpersonal dynamics in the family and children and conflict? And you're dealing with all this thinking, maybe I shouldn't say anything because I don't want to complain. Did you have these types of emotions?
I did, and any complaints I might have had were, I considered, minor. Mm-hmm. They just didn't stack up to what my wife was faced with. So,
they were important.
They were, and you know, at that point, my support group was friends and neighbors and folks at church, and that was helpful. But you know, I guess I probably didn't open up as much as I could have, which is another reason I'm thrilled that we have something that's organized now and encouraging caregivers to come in and visit and to open up and talk and to seek information.
The other thing that strikes me is we want families to be as involved as they can be and as involved as the patient or loved one with cancer, you know, will have them be. But how do you guide families in navigating this desire to care for them, but also respect their privacy or respect their desire for autonomy to make their own decisions?
Wow. And you would have to have known Jane to know that she would have it no other way, that it was going to be Jane's way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a wonderful example of that, a couple of weeks before Jane passed away, all of the children were at home, and we were by her bedside. She had a hospital bed downstairs in the den. Hospice had come in and was helping. And we were talking with her about the plans for her memorial service. And this is something our family was very comfortable discussing. And so Jane kind of drifted off to sleep, and we all quietly moved into the breakfast room, and we were talking. And suddenly a voice pops up from the other room. "That isn't what I said. Mark, our son, come over here and get a piece of paper. I want you to write this down." So, you know, I think it's important that if the patient with cancer wants to maintain control, by all means, let them. Don't take that away from them.
Well, you know, we're going to put a bookmark in this conversation. We're going to come right back and pick up on these themes of autonomy and support and compassion. We're talking with Loretta Muss and Ryan Keith with the North Carolina Cancer Hospital Patient and Family Advisory Board about cancer care and families. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Ryan Keith and Loretta Muss with the North Carolina Cancer Hospital Patient and Family Advisory Board about cancer care and families. And Loretta, like many people around the state and around the country, my own family and extended family is dealing right now with an ill family member with advanced cancer. And one of the questions I have as a family member is, we need access to social workers and therapists to really help not the person who has the cancer, but really the family members who are really struggling here. How do we provide those types of resources to family members of those with cancer?
Well, we're very fortunate at the North Carolina Cancer Hospital because we have the Comprehensive Cancer Support Program, and that's overseen by Dr. Dawn Rosenstein, who's a psychiatrist. Within that program, we have nurses who are psychiatric nurses. We have palliative care. We have pharmacy. We also have the resource center where folks can go in and get lots and lots of materials at the same time. We can fit women with wigs, hats, etc. There's a massage area and a spa pod where caregivers can come in and just relax with no interruptions. So the care is in place. We do have social workers, et cetera, that will point you in the right direction. And we want people to know that cancer is a tough illness. And anywhere you go, just sitting around this table, someone has a story to share. So we've all been touched by this disease, usually always a family member. And it's so important to know that there's something to fall back on, something professional that will help you. Because a lot of people will say, am I making the right decision? Am I being selfish? I shouldn't be here. I should be taking care of my loved one.
And does every patient and caregiver who comes into the cancer hospital know about these resources? Do you point them all to make sure everyone gets the comprehensive care?
We are working on it diligently. We actually just got approval to get television monitors to be able to share this information. We have volunteers who go up and visit with patients and give out information about support programs. The staff knows about it, so they refer a lot of folks to the Comprehensive Cancer Support Program. We're constantly busy. And we're adding more staff because the need is increasing. We see 4,500 new cancer patients a year at the North Carolina Cancer Hospital.
Wow.
That's a lot.
That's impressive.
Well, and
a lot.
If you were talking about also now serving their family members,
right.
Now you're talking about well over 10,000.
Yeah.
and how one defines even family, the family of the community, the family of the church. And I guess, Ryan, one of the questions that Christy and I are really interested in, we see you now volunteering and advocating on behalf of others. Is the experience for you of now advocating for family members who are dealing with a family member with cancer a way of empowering and taking your wife's memory forward? Is that a healing way of getting involved? And how do you then have this conversation with other family members at some point in time about their own empowerment after they maybe lose a loved one or while their loved one is ill?
I think healing very well describes what this does for me. It is, it has a powerful healing effect to be able to feel that I'm helping someone else, and also remembering my wife in doing this. Jane was a powerful advocate for many of her relatives and friends. Jane had been a registered nurse. And frequently, if someone in the neighborhood or a family member was sick, she would go with them to the hospital because she didn't mind asking the tough questions to the doctor, where in many cases, patients don't want to do that. So it is in that memory that I participate in this role. In talking with caregivers, in our sessions with them, first of all, I want to be a good listener. And then I will contribute if it's appropriate. But I do like to encourage them to seek out help from their community of faith, from their houses of worship, to use an organization called CaringBridge.com. So many of the people that we hear from say, I get all these phone calls. And, you know, with CaringBridge, all of their loved ones and friends can get a report together. And so it means one entry on behalf of the caregiver.
Mm-hmm. I also wonder, a big part of the role of a caregiver is to advocate. So you're talking about going to the doctor appointments, going to the hospital, asking the tough questions, or checking to make sure the medicines are, you know, right. We've talked about, Adam and I've talked about that a great deal on the show, the importance of really being an advocate as a family member. But you know, you're just sort of forced into that role. And I wonder, in the kind of resources that you have, what advice do you give to families facing a new cancer diagnosis or an ongoing one of how to advocate well?
And how can you can you teach it even?
Yeah.
To
is
family
it something
members?
You
is this
can
part
teach?
Of your conversations to teach?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. And that's what we're trying to teach them, that it's okay to be angry, how to ask for help, how to make lists. One of the other participants on this on the cancer conversation caregiver conversations is a caregiver of a best friend So he was the one that organized the neighborhood. He was the one that put the list together. Because
when you say list, I'm sorry. Tell us what you mean by list.
A list is meals, mowing the lawn, walking the dog, getting the groceries in, arranging for the house to be cleaned. If you're a woman, these are things that are very important to you. If you're a man, there are other things that are very important to you. And so what Ryan and Hutch and a few other of the caregivers that are on this committee bring to this is their personal experience. And so not only do they share that with these folks who come, but they also validate the concerns of the participants, and it's worked really well. At the last one of the ladies left, and she said, "Could you do this every week? I really need this."
I also wonder, are there aspects that caregivers need to learn or be taught or framed about how to navigate with their loved one different either cultural expectations or opinions about what they would want for their own body versus what the patient with cancer wants and needs for their approach to cancer? Do you have any examples of where that differs?
Okay. At this point, are we talking about contemplation of end of life?
Well, maybe a patient doesn't want something done, but a family member feels like, we've not exhausted chemotherapy and radiation therapy and not ready to change letting go or the other way.
Yeah. I would strongly encourage all patients to have a living will and express their feelings down to the letter. And then share that information with the family members so no one gets blindsided.
Mm-hmm.
But just simply say, these are my wishes. This is what I want to have done. And it's legal. It's in a document. And I expect you to abide by that.
The advanced planning being
the key
part of that.
Right. And the Resource Center does have that information available to patients and caregivers. They have it in a folder so that they have the advanced directives. They do have power of attorney, all this stuff, so that patients and caregivers can be prepared ahead of time.
Wonderful.
I have one last question, which is, I unfortunately have some friends also suffering from cancer at a young age, and they have children. What type of resources are available in the cancer hospital for the children and support of them, which are a whole set of different needs? What are the resources?
We have started, actually it's about a year old. There's this fabulous program that this gentleman named Justin Yop, who's a PhD, who is working with fathers of young children who've lost their spouses. And they just got a grant to keep this going, to videotape it, to share it around the country. It has been amazing. Pediatric Oncology is working on setting up an advisory council, and part of their job list, for want of a better word, is to set up more programs that are available for supportive services for families. So we're constantly learning, and we're constantly working on improving support for our patients and caregivers.
Well, thank you both for being with us today. For our listeners who want to know more information about resources from the North Carolina Health Cancer Hospital, is there, I just go to UNC Cancer Care on Google and they can find that information?
If they go on the Lineberger Cancer website and you just click in there, there will be the Comprehensive Cancer Support Program, and it lists everything that is available to both patients and caregivers.
And we'll put that
put
on our blog.
On our radio show.
Thanks. That'd
Thank
be
you
great.
So much for sharing your compassion, your expertise, and yourselves and your stories. Thank you for what you've been doing.
Thank you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For House Calls, Christy, on our show, we're going to talk about our listeners' health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu, or you can check out our new iPhone app and send it to us that way.
Yeah, well, you can actually go to the iPhone store or even the Android store, and if you put in Your health, radio,
three
UNC
separate words,
healthcare and family medicine, any combination of those, you'll come to our application and you can start following and listening. Very convenient.
Pretty easy to send us questions, so we want some more today.
Challenging ones.
Today we've got some great ones.
Okay, what's our very first question about diabetes?
A friend of mine has diabetes. Could you explain the difference between the two types?
Well, the two different types. There's type 1 and there's type 2. That's an easy. I know it's a lot more than that, isn't it, though, Christy?
It sure is. I mean, it's confusing to people, but in type 1, people usually don't make insulin. In type 2, it's more of a problem of not being able to use the insulin for energy in your body.
Yeah, and frequently we think of type 1 as affecting people who are younger and type 2 affecting people who are older. Type 1 people aren't usually necessarily overweight. Type 2, they tend to be overweight. There's a lot of crossover, but that's a pretty straightforward way. And regardless, you need to follow your blood sugars and
your blood
be
pressure.
Managed. And the closer you get your blood sugars down to normal, the healthier you'll be.
It's true. Hopefully that shed some light on it. And we can put some information on our blog as well. Our fantastic librarians at the Health Sciences Library will put something up about just some basics about diabetes.
Yep. A lot of research is happening. We look forward to hearing more questions. Next listener house call question has to do with something that happens to a lot of people around this time of year. They have colds.
It's happening to me right now. Excuse my voice, everyone.
We'll have to figure out if Christy needs this.
I know. So this is about Zicam.
I have recently caught a cold and have considered using Zicam, which is supposed to help you get over it faster. What do you think about the drug? And do you think it will really work?
Well, what they're talking about here is actually a proprietary. It's a branded product that contains zinc. And the question that really comes up is, does this or products that contain zinc really help people with colds?
Well, I was glad to find that there was a recent review of multiple different studies.
A systematic review.
Yes, finding that zinc intake was associated with a reduction in the duration and the severity. So how long a cold lasts and how bad it is if you take it, you know, as soon as you get symptoms of a cold.
And what about any side effects? Do we know anything about side effects of zinc? Because I have heard that there are some, I don't know if it's taste or
it is
gastrointestinal and acid.
You got it. Bad taste, nausea, and problems with like smell. And in fact,
those aren't small necessarily, but maybe it's worth it.
Well, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration gave like a public health advisory about Zicam and other zinc like products that go into your nose, saying that, you know, they shouldn't. It can really affect your nose.
Yeah, I've heard is Zicam goes into the nose.
I think so.
And there's actually I've read some class action lawsuits on the product. So I think it's. You know, it's difference between saying zinc in a supplement or a lozenge for a common cold that probably doesn't have a lot of side effects, may or may not help you, versus potentially this particular branded product that there are people that have described some serious potential adverse effects. So I would be very cautious about this particular product.
I would too.
Okay. Well, we're in agreement. Thank you for your question. And let's talk about the very next house call about another problem, particularly for a lot of us guys who are in our early retirement thinking phase.
What are you?
51 and going out there and playing sports and getting injured.
Okay.
Let's hear the question.
I'm 55 years old and recently have been having pain in my groin and hip muscles. Do you think stretching and exercise would help, or should I first consult a physical therapist?
Oh, they're older than me, Christy. They're 55.
Oh, gosh. So, you know, pain in your groin and your hip muscles, really common. And if you feel like that is just a soreness because you've gone out and started exercising again or a new routine, then doing some stretching and exercising and sort of just light aerobic walking or moving your body, it sounds to me like that would be a reasonable thing to do, that you wouldn't necessarily have to see a physical therapist first before doing some of those lower, you know, lower risk types of things like walking and stretching.
Yeah. I would also encourage you, it doesn't even have to be a physical therapist. It can be a personal trainer.
Mm-hmm.
It can be anyone that has the knowledge that can really work with you. Sometimes it's one thing to know that you should be doing these stretching exercises. It's another thing to actually start doing them. And if someone really instructs you in them and helps you do them and shows you which ones to do that stretch which muscles, it really could be helpful. So I think there's absolutely no risk here. It's a really good thing to do.
I think so, too. And you could start out doing some low things, and then if you're not better or if you have an injury, make sure to consult somebody who knows what they're talking about.
The good news is the physical therapist would probably get paid for if you have insurance.
Right.
The personal trainer might
probably
not. So, okay,
let's take our last one.
I'm planning a scuba trip, and it's cheaper for me to get a return flight right after I go scuba diving later in the day. But is it safe to me to get on an airplane after scuba diving?
Okay, Adam, you're a scuba diver, right?
Well, I think that's probably an overstatement. I have scuba dived. I enjoyed scuba diving, and it's fun. I'll say that. And also, you have to be aware of the risk of scuba diving. And this listener is sharing with us one of the concerns about if you have problems with decompression sickness or concerns about that, you have to put into when you can fly again because of the changes in pressure can cause some serious problems.
Yeah, and if you fly within 12 hours of scuba diving, if you're just somebody who does one-time scuba diving that day, that increases your chance for this decompression sickness that can be really dangerous. So the recommendation is to wait 12 hours before flying, after you've gone scuba diving. But if you go multiple times in a day scuba diving, or if you go so deep that you have to come up for like a decompression stop.
Right. So that example of that is when my wife and I on our honeymoon went scuba diving and we went down 100 feet. Well, you had to stop every 20 or 30 feet coming up for a minute to avoid any decompression sickness by coming up. On the other hand, if you just go down 10 feet, which the majority of great scuba diving, you can see 6, 8, 10
That's
feet
my
down.
Kind.
You know, it's like going down to the bottom of the pool.
Right.
You know, you hear your ears pop, but there's really no risk there. So,
but in the case, I hope that you and your wife waited. In the case that you go so deep that you have to do these decompression stops, you're supposed to wait 48 hours before flying.
You know,
I mean, that's a general expert recommendation.
I can
anyway.
Tell you she's never going down to 100 feet again after she said, "What is that over there?" And we came back up and I said, "Oh, that was a barracuda."
Oh, wow.
Well, Christy, that concludes our house calls today. We've had some wonderful questions. And thank you for all of our listeners for your questions. And feel free to send us your questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and our new health app.
And don't forget about our blog, just yourhealthradio.org, and we'll point you to all those other options there as well.
We'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guests today, Loretta Muss and Ryan Keith.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We will look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.